Pontoon, bass boat, canoe, and kayak rentals for sport, leisure, or fishing. Services include concessions, bait, and propane. Details at muckyduckmarina.com or 747-DUCK. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It's a quirky world of might have been with the Bloomington Cogs and Corsets Festival. Organizer Melanie Shellerta says steampunk can even be multi-generational.
We would see a mom with her daughter and her mom. So three generations would come, they'd get their tea pass, and they'd go and enjoy tea together, and they were all having a great time.
A mix of Victoriana, science fantasy, and role-playing. Plus, learn about another quirky passion, British car collecting, in this year's featured model at the Champaign British Car Show at the David Davis Mansion. Dave Howman joins us. And Mayor Terry Renner of Bloomington stops by to talk TIFFs. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington aldermen are trying to clarify when the city is willing to use a common but controversial tax incentive tool for development projects and what it means for local schools when they do. GLT's Ryan Dunham covered last night's Bloomington City Council meeting and is in studio for a recap with Mayor Terry Renner.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us after their regular and special council meetings. Mayor Terry Renner, thanks for coming in again.
Thank you, Ryan.
Aldermen are considering approval of guidelines that would spell out how and when the city can use tax increment financing, or TIF districts, to redevelop struggling areas. The city has used TIFs before. Normal did the same with Uptown. You're talking about this now in part because the city is considering two new TIF districts, one for this East Washington Street corridor, another at that former Electrolux property north of downtown. District 87 is getting a say in what those guidelines will be because, I mean, local schools are most impacted when you start adjusting property tax dollars. So what did you think of last night's relatively civil discussion on kind of a thorny topic?
Oh, I thought it was very, very, very good. And I think we had lots of different perspectives, lots of different, as I say, viewpoints. But mostly they were not contradictory. Certainly Kathy Orr, who is our primary attorney on this, she has 40 years worth of experience in law and local government, particularly with respect to economic development and TIFs, was there to kind of give us a reality check. We've had our attorneys. We've had our economic development people in District 87. It is notable, however, that Unit 5, even though 60% of the city of Bloomington is in Unit 5, was not there. No other taxing bodies were there. It was just District 87. And I think they're the ones who were most concerned about TIFs as we go forward. There have been abuses of TIFs in Bloomington, frankly, going back into the 80s and 90s. Now, Alderman Mathey did note that the returns on that, in spite of perhaps the abuses of that TIF, exceeded inflation by about 5%. So I would characterize just the overall conversation between Alderman and our partners in District 87 to be very, very productive.
And just to catch folks up, if you're not totally familiar with the concept of a TIF, here's kind of the nutshell version. A designated TIF district diverts any new taxes generated by an increase in property values back into the redevelopment of that area, usually for 23 years. And municipal leaders generally say that TIF provides incentives to land these big projects without, like, dipping into your current budget. There are critics, though, who say that TIF districts can kind of needlessly erode the tax base. They say there's sometimes lack of transparency. So that's sort of where the controversy comes
Absolutely.
In.
Absolutely. It was, I would say, more than anything, it was the lack of transparency in Bloomington in the 80s and especially in the 90s in how the money was doled out. And I think that that's still leaving a bad taste in the mouth of many, not just in District 87, but obviously this is a new day in Bloomington, and the way that we're approaching TIFs is much more surgical. Obviously, without TIFs, you wouldn't have Uptown Normal. You'd still have vacant lots and vacant properties and an EPA Superfund waysite. So we know that TIFs can be successful if they are used surgically and carefully, and I think that's what we had consensus on within the council last night. And in fact, that was the proposed ordinance that our staff put together.
District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley spoke to Alderman last night. His major point was, hey, before you use these tax incentives, think twice, because property tax dollars are very precious for schools. So here's what he had to say.
The idea that we are not hurt, we being District 87, by a TIF, because it will still be receiving the same amount of revenue received before the TIF, is simply wrong.
So what do you think of that central point, that TIFs are not this harmless tool, at least from a school district's perspective?
Once again, it depends upon how it's structured. Mostly, if you structure your TIF properly, your District 87s or your, obviously, Unit 5s or whoever, as I say, Unit 5 wasn't even there last night, they didn't have any concerns, can be very positive. Just, again, it depends on whether you're sloppy in using your TIF, whether you're transparent in using your TIF, whether or not it's very small and tight and surgical. In fact, the biggest TIF of the two that we passed since I've been mayor, one is just a couple blocks by the front and center building, very, very tight. And the other one that's not very tight, and the reason why it's not tight is because we've stretched over so we could include District 87's buildings, so we could funnel any possible surplus that we might get from the Empire Crossing TIF, which is the old Colonial Plaza, so we could funnel some of that money to District 87. Because obviously, no city is going to thrive economically if you don't have a great school system. So all those things we can certainly agree with. The only thing I would take issue is I think the Barry's statement is sometimes something we hear, but it's not one that I would ever make. I'd talk about TIFs in a broader sense, not just the area that you are TIFing, but you're going to have economic spillovers to the areas surrounding the TIF. And so those are the areas that almost immediately within 3 years construction, and then you pay your taxes a year later, et cetera, that school districts will benefit from. And in the long run, they'll benefit a lot.
You talked about how one way to mitigate the potential impact of a TIF is just the way you structure it. And so Superintendent Riley talked about that kind of thing last night. You know, is that giving back some of the money collected, the surplus increment, as it's called? Is that investing some of the money into the schools directly, as you sort of just referenced now? Is that cutting the TIF period short so they don't have to wait a full 23 years to do that? So when you say structure, what are some of the alternative structure that you
There's
think,
so many.
What's a good one that you want to use maybe as an example?
First of all, of our two TIFs, the one that's the most tightly structured is the one on the front and center building. It includes the front and center building and just the areas like right across the street. So, you've got a few thousand square feet. It's specifically designed for a project across from the Coliseum. Okay. It doesn't even include the Pantograph building. Right. So it's very tightly, structured. And then when somebody comes in with a deal, that doesn't necessarily mean that they automatically get 23 years worth of freezing their property taxes. In fact, every year you have to apply. That's the thing that people don't understand, to get, in a sense, the property taxes that you've already paid into the fund. Right. And the other thing is that there's a lag, because if let's say somebody comes in and signs a fantastic deal tomorrow. Actually, I've got somebody coming in this afternoon, but we won't be signing the deal today. But if somebody signed a wonderful deal tomorrow, it would take probably at least a year for that to be built. By the time then it's assessed and then you pay your first property tax bill, it's going to usually take up to about 3 years, as Kathy Orr noted last night, before you begin to see any money. We are slowly beginning to see a little bit of money trickling in from the Empire Crossing TIF, the old Colonial Plaza, which, again, we had a virtually abandoned shopping mall, and now we've got an engine of economic growth. Now, we may need to do the same thing right across the street for Eastland Mall. And my concern about Eastland Mall is a different story, of course, for a different day. I'm just concerned that they're going to Band-Aid it rather than try to have a comprehensive approach. But that might very well require a TIF. So but there are sales taxes there, right? So the TIF would be the last resort. It depends on how aggressive they wanted to make the project. So a TIF a TIF would have a maximum. So let's say, all right, you get a certain amount of money. If you're going to invest $40 million, let's say, we will rebate up to $8 million in property tax increases, essentially, because of your investment. But not a dime more than $8 million or $5 million or whatever the amount might be. So the project has to pay for itself. So in the absence of the private investment, there is not a penny in TIF money. And so that's what there was somebody at public comment who said, well, we don't want businesses who come in with their hands out. This has nothing to do with having your hands out. You can have your hands out all day long. You're not getting a penny until you come up with a multi-million dollar investment. And then as that increases the value of your property, there may be an increment of that that we consider rebating back to you. And that doesn't mean that you automatically get it.
Well, you've referenced that historically the city of Bloomington has abused the TIF system. You said the 80s and the 90s.
I would say the 1986 TIF by downtown. And I'm not saying, and as Alderman Mathey pointed out, that even that TIF of 54 blocks.
And that stretched all the way until 2009.
Stretched to 2009. That's right. 54 blocks is not surgical, right? A block and a half to two blocks of a downtown area right by the Coliseum is surgical. 54 blocks, which is the entire downtown of Bloomington, is not surgical. And the way that it was administered, I think it's not unsafe to say that a lot of, or inaccurate to say, that a good portion of that was kind of operated by the previous city, three city managers ago. And in a very non-transparent way. Those days are gone. The days of good old boy dealings in Bloomington, the days of a lack of transparency and closed doors in City Hall, the days that we operated like a Soviet gulag in terms of how closed we were, are gone. We are as open and transparent as we can be. Doesn't mean we can't continue to improve, but we're trying to move forward with that. No money will be spent until it's vetted. This will be all public. The public will have involvement in this, as will District 87. And I'm sure, Perry Riley wasn't there, but I'm sure he knows the stories of the 90s where District 87 was shut out pretty much in the early 2000s. District 87 had very little to do with that. We want to partner with them because obviously they have to succeed in order for our community to succeed.
What's a specific way that the city is being more transparent about how TIF money is distributed these days?
Well, the fact that you know exactly what's happening. Obviously, we have to have public hearings, and we've had subsequent public discussions about that. I've had people coming to my open houses almost, because I have an open house prior to every council meeting. What is a TIF? Because people are still understandably confused about that. So we've got information on our website, the contracts. Everything is out there for anyone to take a look at. There's nothing that's being hidden except for, it could be, it hasn't happened yet, but proprietary information that a private business might not want out. And that's one of the reasons why that information would usually be provided to a third party who does vetting. Because most anything that you send to the city of Bloomington can be FOIA'd and then could be public record. And so there are some companies that don't want their competitors to see all of their finances without them seeing all of, their competitors' finances.
On the surface, it looked a little contentious, right? And you have District 87 saying to Bloomington, hey, don't give away our tax money. But from where I was sitting, I was also struck by how much you're in the same boat. You've got flattening tax revenues. You're not getting any help from the state. You have pressure to make improvements, but no money to do it. Did you sense that commonality, too, that camaraderie with Barry Riley as he was talking to you guys?
Absolutely. And I talked to Barry and many of the school board members from, and obviously Mark Daniel from Unit 5 and their school board members, all the time. Of course, we're in the same boat. We're in a situation where our property taxes are flat or perhaps even slightly declining. I mean, that varies from month to month, but absolutely. Our sales taxes. And then our property taxes, we have not raised property taxes in Bloomington since 2008. We leave property taxes to the schools, whether it's District 87 or Unit 5. So as much as possible, we are trying to swim upstream. So I think there are the commonalities. The thing, though, at the end of the day that I think we have to realize, and I hope that District 87 people began to realize, is the nature of how cautious we have been with TIFs and how good a partnership, if you were aggressive, like Unit 5 and the town of Normal. They were very aggressive, and they worked together. So I think there's some important reasons why we need to work together. But at the end of the day, the city of Bloomington does not run elementary and secondary education. And there's no reason why we should even give our opinion as to how District 87 ought to operate its school system. One of the key functions, if not the most important function of a city government, especially a metro city whose home rule is economic development. And I did ask Kathy Orr, because the District 87 attorney wanted edits to our TIF policy. And I had asked her before the meeting, I said, have you ever heard of a school board or a school attorney from a school district rewrite a TIF or economic development policy for a home rule metro city? And she said, no, that's absurd. It'd be like shooting yourself in the foot. So they do need to understand that we have a variety of things. What you see depends on where you sit. And we are responsible for economic development. We do want strong schools. We are all in the same boat. We want to use TIF as a last resort, but there are times where we have to use TIF. As Kathy Orr noted, and one of our staff members, and I believe our attorney noted, that is our regular corporate attorney, Mr. Juergens, if we accepted the language of District 87's attorney, we would almost never, if ever, be able to use TIFs. So that's just unacceptable. And I know it might not be popular with a few, but at the end of the day, that's just the reality. And that's not just the reality here in Bloomington. It's the reality throughout the United States. School boards do deal with elementary secondary education. General purpose governments and metro cities deal with economic development.
The late wrinkle in this discussion was a request from local union leaders to consider including project labor agreement language in these TIF guidelines. So those PLAs, as they're called, are typically between a municipality or developer and the local trades, essentially saying that all construction hiring on TIF-related projects would be done through local hiring halls. So what do you think of that idea?
I think the overall concept, by the way, of a prevailing wage, which was also brought up, is already part of our policy. So we, you know, the multiplier effect of, let's say, a $12 million project, just because I think that's going to be roughly the size of the one that I'm going to be talking about today. The multiplier effect for a $12 million project varies depending on what economist you talk about. But if you have something where you are hiring local and the money stays local, it certainly increases exponentially. Whether or not it's three times or it's five times the amount of money, it certainly increases. So I am definitely in favor of project labor agreements as well as prevailing wage.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Mayor Renner, the City Council last night also approved the rules and procedures for the Public Safety and Community Relations Board. And that's the Civilian Police Advisory Board created last summer as a way of hopefully inoculating against flare-ups between police and people of color they serve and protect. So what do you think so far of what the board has done in terms of getting up off the ground, getting these rules in place?
I think they've done an outstanding job of doing that. One thing I think that they maybe could do more of, maybe what we need is to work with our IT so that they can have a web page and maybe or a Facebook page so that they'd be more aggressive perhaps in social media. But that would be my only. And I don't know if that's a criticism. That's just they're getting off the ground. Right?
I think the marketing and communication of a board like this is so important because
it is very important.
The people who may need it are maybe not glued to their YouTube stream on Monday nights watching city council meetings.
Right now, it is a little bit. You know, they began. This was approved last July, and then I asked the council for nominees. We approved, roughly in October, the board was approved, and then they first met in December, and they've been meeting regularly and had their quarterly meeting in March. They're having their next major quarterly meeting in June. There have been no complaints so far that have been lodged, which has been helpful. It gives them a little breathing room to figure out what their bylaws are going to be, what the procedures are going to be. But getting the word out for people. I believe they said they had a couple of dozen people at their March meeting, and that's good. So that people throughout the city realize what they're doing. The whole concept is, again, a police as well as citizens review board means to try to bring citizens and police more closely together so that we don't have incidents like you've seen in other cities. So situations do not become explosive.
And the board's chairman, Art Taylor, spoke to Alderman last night. He said they put a lot of thought into this notion of confidentiality. So making sure that board members are not privy to the name of the complainants and the officers involved and all the people involved as they're sort of looking at the nitty-gritty of the case. And that gets tricky because they
it's
also have to
tricky.
Make sure they don't have a conflict of interest, right? So how do you do that if you don't know the names? So what do you think of what you've seen so far in terms of the board is approaching this issue of confidentiality?
Well, I think that's one that they're going to need to work with the attorneys on more carefully because, for example, WGLT, if there was an event, a situation, hopefully there's... I'd love to believe that there will never be a situation where anyone is criticized in the Bloomington Police Department. But at some point, under most circumstances, you can get that information with the FOIA. And so it is a very, very tricky ground that they're going to need very strong legal advice on. And I do understand why you need confidentiality so you can just look at the merits of the case and why the police chief made the decision that he made. And it may be that then the role of the review board ends and says, hey, we think the police chief, you know, was too tough, was not tough enough, or that we agree with the decision of the chief. And then that ends. But it's hard to believe that the first few cases that come forward, whenever they come forward, are not going to be major news. And maybe more bigger news than they normally would be under circumstances because this is a new board.
Mayor Terry Renner, thanks for coming in today.
Sure. Thanks, Ryan.
I'm Ryan Denham.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us after their regular and special council meetings next week. You'll hear from Mayor Chris Koos of the town of Normal.
Support for GLT comes from Home Sweet Home Ministries. This month, Home Sweet Home's ambitious fundraising goal is within reach thanks to the help of donors matching gifts of up to $81,500. Details at hshministries.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, can you say vroom vroom in a British accent? A car show. For Bloomington Normal, we'll have more on that. Downtown Bloomington becomes a world of fanciful what-ifs in history, fashion, and science this weekend. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more on the return of a unique event.
Cogs and Corsets, a Central Illinois steampunk happening, returns to downtown Bloomington in a celebration of elaborate costuming, outrageous gadgetry, and history, both real and imagined. Melanie Shelito and Kathy Sutliff are two of the organizers of the event that features both free and ticketed events and runs this Friday through Sunday. This is the second year for Cogs and Corsets. It follows a debut year that Melanie Shelito considers a marvelous success.
We had no idea what to expect. We hoped that the community would turn out. And not only did the local community turn out, but we had folks come out of the woodwork from Chicago, Wisconsin, Missouri.
Steampunk tourism, then.
Oh, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Steampunk people like to travel. It's amazing.
So there was enough success for the first year. You decided to go with a second year with Cogs and Corsets. Are you setting the bar higher this year?
It got bigger, yeah, because I think what I know what happened was that the vendors that we had and the performers that we had, you know, the steampunk community is pretty interwoven and they're pretty well connected. And those people and the visitors went back home to their own groups and their own people and they went, wow, Bloomington Normal put on an amazing event. It was year one and it was unbelievable. So next thing we know, these performers, like Oklahoma, they're reaching out to us saying, hey, can we come and perform for you? And so these actually very well-known performers and troops and individuals are reaching out saying, we heard great things. And our vendors, oh my goodness, we have vendors from like five states.
Oh, easily more than that, yeah.
Yeah.
Florida, Alabama, Missouri, Iowa.
What are they vending?
We actually, I'm excited. We have a ceramist this year, so we have some artwork in there. But we have hat makers and clothing makers and jewelry makers and people who make odd objects out of found pieces, obtanium, as was one phrase they use.
Obtanium. I love that.
Wherever you can get it.
Yeah.
And we have several authors of steampunk novels, which is exciting. We have one group coming in who's going to be vending out of a Vardo wagon.
A Vardo wagon?
Yeah. You know, the painted wagons that the Romani people, they've got one, and they vend out of it. So we're going to have that, I think, Pride of Place downtown. It's going to be a spectacle, to be sure.
Is this a family-friendly event?
Oh, certainly. Most definitely. Matter of fact, we are lucky enough that we have the Children's Discovery Museum partnering with the Museum of History to do family-friendly events on the grass, both Saturday and Sunday. Oh, and Friday night as well.
Maybe some croquet will be in the offing?
Sunday, it will be open croquet on the lawn, but the kids' activities are actually STEAM activities.
Really? I love that.
So they'll be making their own little...
The parachutes?
That's right. Well, airships that they're racing with the airships.
There's an airship race?
There's a Van de Graaff machine so that you can put your hand on it and your hair all stands out. So that's the science behind a lot of these period things. And oh, yeah, it's going to be amazing.
Now, we all know what steampunk looks like, and it's sort of like future past kind of style wise.
The future that never was.
Exactly. But what is steampunk underneath? What is the spirit of steampunk?
So my favorite is actually sort of stolen from Eric Larson from TeslaCon, and what it becomes, at least to me, and everybody's got their own take, but it becomes this really creative community of people who are makers and artists and theater, and it is an inclusive group to be how you interpret steampunk to be. So you get to sort of create your own reality, you get to bring your own vision to this, and when all these different people with different visions get together, it becomes this beautiful cacophony of who my persona is. And so I would say inclusiveness is the way to go. You see everything, and it's all okay.
Yeah, and that's the best part, is that there is no right answer. It's not that steampunk is this way. It's steampunk is what you want to make it. You don't have to dress up in the fancy costumes if you don't want to. If you're really into the literature or really into the music, just come and enjoy that. You can enjoy various aspects of it and not have to take the whole pie.
It's one of the things I think when we've talked to this about, they say, well, I don't have any outfits. I'd feel weird. Please don't, because when you come, even if you never intend to put on a bustle or a corset or a top hat, you're going to come and you're just going to be amazed at the skill and the artistry and the fantasy of other people. We had an attendee last year say to one of us organizers, this was so incredible. It was like having a little slice of Disneyland right here in downtown, because everywhere you look, there's exotic, there's color, there's just people having just a really great time. And I think in our staid little Midwestern mind, like, that doesn't happen here.
Yes.
And so, I mean, it's alive and well. The fantasy occurs. And what was kind of neat we saw last year was there's one, the thing that's called, we have a tea room. It happens in the History Museum. And it's a little $5 pass, and you get 3 punches to go up. We have a British woman, Lady Garden, that runs our tea room. She's from the UK, so it's very legit. She's got all this vintage tea set, right? So you can go up there, have tea, you know. And we would see a mom with her daughter and her mom. So 3 generations would come, they'd get their tea pass, and they'd go and enjoy tea together, and they were all having a great time. They didn't necessarily dress up, but they came and experienced it, and they experienced it together. And I think that was just a really amazing thing.
You have a headliner who will be a part of this event, Professor Pike. Tell me about him. Kathy?
Oh, he's pretty fabulous. The best part about him is that he does his research. A lot of times you will see panels that are all fantasy-based, and people will talk about werewolves and things like that, and that's fine. But he does his serious research. So if he's talking about airships, Victorian airships going to the moon, he goes back and does the research about the patents that were designed at that time period and what people were intending to do to actually go.
So were there actually patents, people wanting to take airships to the moon in the Victorian era?
Many.
Yeah? I love these people.
There was an interesting thing in the documentary that we had showing on the 12th and the 22nd, that talked about the different attitude that the Victorians had compared to what we have. You have cyberpunk is usually dystopia, where the world has been destroyed and everyone's kind of angry and they're trying to build themselves up. The thing about steampunk is in the Victorian era, they had a different approach to things. They were hopeful. They wanted to do things. They were like, we're going to make it to the moon. We're going to solve this problem. And they had the hope that was in them that is so different than what you can see today.
And that is a part of the current steampunk movement.
Yes. Yeah. And a good dose of whimsy. Very yeah. important to have the whimsy.
And I
there.
Will say that Professor Pike's, we have him doing three different talks. They're all rather different. One is about this Victorian spacecraft. One is for the technology behind airships. And then one is H.G. Wells and the War of the Worlds and sort of its evolution and what it means to us.
So you do have a number of ticketed events like the tea, but you also have a lot of free events like the facial hair contest. Can you give us some tips?
That's new this year. That's new this year. So it could be anything. We don't know what to expect, but it's been getting a lot of buzz on Facebook.
But there's so much great facial hair out there right now. It seems to me this might be pretty stiff competition. So any tips for people who are entering this contest?
We're very pleased that The Stash, which is a salon for men, has joined in with us because they have a steampunk approach to their salon and decor. And so they're sponsoring this event. That'll be happening on Saturday afternoon, late Saturday afternoon. A lady can participate if she'd like. But
no judging.
But a gentleman may want to go and invest in some beeswax or some sort of mustache wax and can do all sorts of different things with the hair on his face.
I think there's going to be, you know, props for creativity and how it aligns with a persona. And yeah, we're getting really serious about this. So have a great time with it.
We do, though, have an event this year that no other STEAM convention has.
What's
You've
that?
Heard it here first.
Okay. Yes. And Melanie, she came up with it. So.
It's our Cogs and Corsets signature event. And it is dirigible races. This one is sort of a walk up, put your name on the list and compete. And so we are so lucky this year to have a retired engineer on our planning staff. We had a cable and we have airships hooked to this cable and we have bellows. And so you are to blow. This is me making my hand action on a bellow. And you move your airship along the cable until it gets to the end and it's got a little pin and whoever pops the balloon at the end. And so I think it's a penny to play to pay for the cost of the balloon. And so it ought to just be a scream and just for all ages and debuting right here in Bloomington Normal.
That's Melanie Shelato and Kathy Sutliff, two of the organizers of Cogs and Corsets, a Central Illinois steampunk happening in downtown Bloomington this Friday through Sunday. I'm Laura Kennedy.
One of the most popular events at any steampunk happening is the teapot race, and Cogs and Corsets is no exception. The weekend also features a Tesla coil demonstration, a murder mystery dinner, and selfie photo op stations. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Heritage Health Therapy and Senior Care. Heritage has been offering specialized health care services to seniors in Bloomington Normal for more than 50 years. On the web at heritageofcare.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Your yard as expression of self coming up in just a moment with GLT's Grow. The Champaign British Car Festival has made an annual appearance in Bloomington since 1991, yet there's something different each year. The chance for car aficionados to get together and talk wrenches and bodies starts again Friday night. Dave Howman is the chair of the organizing committee.
We have, for the car owners, we have an informal social hour at the Host Hotel Hawthorne Suites, and we're delighted to have Tim Suttard, who is the publisher and founder of Sports Car Magazine, Classic Motorsports, to be our guest for the weekend.
Every year there's a featured model, a featured car. It's been DeLoreans, it's been MGs, it's been Jaguars. What have you picked this year?
This year it's going to be Minis, both old and new. So you'll see a couple of the classic Minis and several of the new version.
From the more recent version of the Italian Job to the Michael Caine version of the Italian
exactly
Job.
Exactly correct.
The Mini Cooper. Why'd you pick that one?
Because we can.
Okay.
We had Minis as the featured mark, oh Lord, several years ago now, and the committee decided it was time to have it again.
What makes it a cool car?
Well, there were several things. One is it was literally a revolutionary design. I don't think they would ever packed so much into so little a package as before the Mini came around. And it became a classic. It was just an instant success, both in sales and in rallying, because of its front-wheel drive and transverse engine. And it's also very interesting, I think, that when you see a new Mini, it immediately invokes the old Mini, and vice versa. But when you put them side by side, the differences in the two cars is amazing. But somehow they remind one of the other.
Is that sort of distinctive feel to the vehicle the province largely of small British car makers, or is it something that is unique to any great designer?
No, I think in fact, in my words to the from the chair this year, I say that very thing, that there are several examples, not least of which is the Mustang. If you see a 64 and a half Mustang and you set it side by side with the new Mustangs, it's immediately recognizable which is which. And yet somehow, you know, the new one invokes the old one evokes the new one. In many ways, same with the Corvette, you know, from the original to its many iterations to the contemporary Corvette. I think the Jaguar E-Type is very evocative of the Jaguar F-Type. So I think that's part of the definition of a classic, you know, that even though they may be come back in a different iteration, they nevertheless somehow remind one of the original.
What other plans do you have to offer the public who might come out to the David Davis Mansion the weekend of June?
Well, we always have a People's Choice Award, so anybody that walks through the gate is handed a ballot and a program and asked to pick the car that they like best. We will have food on the grounds, thanks to Redbird Catering, so they don't have to run out and buy lunch someplace or hurry themselves and make lunch at home. And we will have Carl's ice cream. So if they have had lunch already someplace, they can have dessert on the mansion as they look at the cars. Virtually all of the owners are very eager and forthright in talking about their cars, the history of their car, what they may have done with the cars, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a fun family event. The Cancer Center, which we've designated as the beneficiary for this year, will also have an informational tent there. And there will be some vendors for folks.
How much have charities benefited in the past from this event?
Well, the last couple of years, it's been $1,000 for each of the designated charities. We decide that after the fact, once we do all the check writing and see how much we have left for the next year.
And how wide a geographical net did you cast for owners of Mini Coopers this year?
Actually, the pre-registrations are ahead of some of the previous years, and we already have folks coming in from Michigan, Iowa, Wisconsin, Missouri, Indiana.
In this era of rapid technological change and the idea that is percolating through society that internal combustion engines are contributing to global climate change, is there a lessening of attraction to classic cars?
Actually, no. Yes, gasoline-powered cars do contribute to pollution, although the efficiency of those engines has increased dramatically in the last 10 to 15 years. And the question is asked, because most of the guys that own these cars are my age, and that ain't no spring chicken. What happens next, you know? And there was just an article in one of the magazines that indicated that the millennials, the generation after us, their interest in the car hobby has increased at the same rate as the baby boomer generation is falling out. So at least according to that magazine article, the fear of the hobby disappearing is essentially unwarranted. The other thing you asked is, you know, the whole autonomous car, e-car developments in the recent years. And while I applaud those, in fact, even Formula One Racing has set up a division for e-cars, no gas-powered cars. The only lament is you can't hear them coming. And so, you know, some of the spectators at Formula One races are disappointed because they don't make any noise. Mm-hmm. And they rather like the noise of a highly tuned gasoline engine. But again, the article indicated there will always be, at least for the foreseeable future, a segment of individuals who enjoy driving their own cars, shifting their own gears, listening to their own engine.
If, as your comment implies, the pickup in interest is related to a stage of life and the ability to devote
sure.
time to a hobby more than it is to a particular generation,
well,
then what kind of classic cars will the next generation devote itself to?
That's a very loaded question. I don't think I'd feel comfortable predicting, other than to say, you know, it's kind of like, what was your favorite music when you were in high school? That's all. There's going to be a part of your bias that likes that music or that dress style or that whatever it was.
So it's not just a matter of stage of life. It's a matter of the stage of life that you were in when you were coming of age.
Harkening back to the past, yes.
Dave Howman is the chair of the organizing committee for the Champaign British Car Festival at the David Davis Mansion Friday through Sunday. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Your yard is more than just a place for plants to grow. It's a blank canvas to create forms. Patrick Murphy has more on this edition of GLT's Grow.
If you're lacking certain landscape elements in your yard, don't worry. You can fake it. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field. From the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum, it's Patrick Murphy. Hello, Murph.
Hello, Laura.
Today on GLT's Grow, creating landscape forms with plants.
So I
we're
love
thinking
this, stuff.
This is so cool because so we're thinking like maybe faking a creek or, you know, creating a berm or something like that.
Yeah, or even the feel. The feel.
Okay.
And so what I always say to try and articulate this point is, you know, when we go on vacation, when you have to leave the Kennedy compound and go somewhere else nice, you oftentimes encounter situations or settings where you say, oh, wow, this just feels great.
Mm-hmm.
There's a feeling that goes with it.
Yes.
Landscape architects, during their training, their education, they'll go and observe people in brand new landscapes. There's been lots of research done on this topic, and the mother concept that covers it all is spatial composition.
Ooh.
Spatial composition. So, you know, you can see gardens that are built with the best of intentions, and they have beauty that's built in. It's natural or intrinsic beauty. And it's also an opportunity to say, well, you know, that's all very nice, but when you planted that tree 10 feet away from the building and now the tree itself is 100 feet wide,
yeah.
all this stuff, it loses a little bit of that feel that we're trying to convey.
Oh, yeah.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
And we've all heard the expression, if you've ever watched HGTV or the Do-It-Yourself Network, good bones.
Mm-hmm.
Good bones. And that expression refers to the structure or form of a room, your wardrobe, how you arrange the furniture in your house, and more importantly to me and you, are the gardening assets, right?
Right.
So in the residential setting, which is the most popular, most common setting for landscape features that are made with plants, you can break these down into architectural aesthetic
mm-hmm.
or engineering features that
Ooh.
Are created by plants.
Okay.
So, Laura, you mentioned the dry riverbeds. They're a great way to use the a landscaping feature to disguise a spot where water temporarily moves
uh-huh.
or where it moves and sticks around for a while, right? And that looks like the dry riverbed or the empty creek bed. But the plants in the landscape can do a lot more heavy lifting than that. So architecturally, plants can make up the floor, the walls, and the ceilings for outdoor living areas. And mainly speaking, the things like the tree trunks and the tree canopies, shrubs all the way down to the what's called the ground cover plane, that's where our turf and flowers are, they create the boundaries for this outdoor living space, and they have implied floors, implied walls, and implied ceilings based on the shapes and the heights of the plants and the manner in which they're arranged. So when you've seen formal landscapes before, particularly in park settings, you might have seen a spot where the trees are planted in allées. That's where the trees are in long columns, evenly spaced apart. They can serve as great boundary markers, but you can also look at those tree trunks like columns on a Roman building.
Yes,
and
yes.
That's where the architect or the designer wants you to look through and know that there's something different on the other side. So say you get the big tall tree next to a small tree, that architect is trying to get you to direct your eyes upward into the open space above the smaller trees. So all these little tricks have an influence on how people behave and perceive their outdoor spaces.
Sounds like you have to be pretty clever. You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. This week, using plants to fake landscape forms. I hate using the word fake, but you
recreate.
Know what I mean. Recreate.
Recreate, yeah. So we talked about the architectural bones being the floors, walls, and ceilings. There's also an aesthetic that's what most people are most interested in.
Certainly.
And those would be plants that are used as visual accents or those that are complementary to a specific architectural style.
Okay, could you be more specific?
Okay, so the building we're sitting in has big columns outside of it.
Mm-hmm.
So if there were tall columnar trees in the front view of that part of the landscape, we're reinforcing that architectural element.
Gotcha.
On the other side of the coin, the visual accent could be one where we found plants or a big plant that has some kind of geometry that's in contrast. So instead of a tall fastidiate type tree that mimics the columns, we would use, say, a weeping tree.
Right.
And then it's like, wow, that's interesting. Well, it's on the right-hand side, which is where a doorway is located. So then the plants are kind of like a marker, like the highest-ranking guard waiting for you to come back to your palace. That's I love that. I've always loved that.
I like that.
And then the size can have a lot to do with that also. So if you are planting your backyard and you want to plant a tree out in the middle of the open lawn for shade, make it a big one.
Oh, yeah, something with a lot of spread.
Something with a lot of spread, something that'll allow for grass to grow beneath it. But that's kind of reinforcing that composition with aesthetics in mind. And then the last thing is the engineering, or that's kind of related to form equals function.
Right.
That engineering applications do, they do control erosion. They can direct the movement of people and vehicles and animals even.
Could you give me an example?
Sure. If we have a walk around the Fell Arboretum part of ISU's quad, you'll see there are diagonal sidewalks.
Yes.
And the diagonal sidewalks are nothing more than a paved path to take you across the cheater's path.
That's exactly right. I mean, there weren't that many sidewalks when I was a student here.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, you would see how the students would take a shortcut across the quad to get from one building to another. And I always figured they eventually just went, let's put in a sidewalk there because they've worn a path.
Well, and that's really common, I think, in institutional settings. But the step that could go a little bit further is where those points merge. You might have something that creates those coalescing points as a gathering area with landscaping that has benches and then the layers of trees that create the feeling of little tiny rooms outside.
Yeah.
That's one thing that we haven't tried here. I'm sure there's spots on campus that we have tried it, but the idea to understand is the bones come from the architecture of the plants. And the plants are selected based on their features and the horticultural requirements that the site affords.
Yeah.
And then the engineering is the function that follows it all. So another example would be a bend in the sidewalk in the front of a house is very common and is left when the builder is finished.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great spot to put a plant of interest is at the bend in your sidewalk, because it gives the reason for the sidewalk to bend.
Yes.
And it prevents you from walking off the edge, you know.
It's like punctuation in a sentence almost.
There's so many things it's related to, but it does follow some grammar laws and things like that. The parallels are definitely there.
Absolutely.
So when you look at the landscape, and think about, you know, I need a fence. Maybe you don't want to build a fence. Maybe it's a great place for you to have your own allee of trees, mm-hmm. or your own large standing hedge. Hedges aren't just the six-footers that we all are accustomed to at the country club.
Right.
But they can also be the hedge that you build between your house and the neighbor that's got the Airstream camper in his backyard.
Okay, some great information, and I like a nice philosophy in there, Murf. So thanks so much for
Thank you.
And coming up next week on GLT's Grow, well, speaking of the Illinois State University campus, discover some noteworthy trees and shrubs. You can come and take a look at them if you live here in Bloomington Normal and get some great ideas for yourself as well. And just take a look at how beautiful the campus is. If you've got a gardening question or problem you'd like Murf to take on, go to our website, wglt.org/grow, fill in the form and send that along to us. We'd love to hear from you. That's wglt.org/grow.
You can subscribe to GLT's Grow podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, a service of Illinois State University's School of Communication. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Laura Kennedy and Ryan Denham. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcasts at WGLT.org or Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.